Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
These discussions with paramilitaries were at play with death.
Remarkable personal stories from around the world.
They don't speak with words, they speak with guns.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Friday, the 3rd of May, these are our main stories. President Biden has warned pro-Palestinian demonstrators at American universities that they don't have a right to cause chaos. An international police operation has uncovered one of the largest networks of fraudulent call centres in Europe, responsible for thousands of scam calls a day. French MPs have voted to set up a commission to investigate sexual abuse in the film industry. Also in this podcast, the smart tree dweller that's learnt how to use plants to heal itself. President Biden has said people have the right to protest, but not to cause chaos, as he addressed the violence and arrests seen at some demonstrations at US universities about the conflict in Gaza. Speaking at the White House, he said the events had put to the test two fundamental American principles, the right to free speech and the rule of law. He stressed both must be upheld. Mr. Biden made the comments on Thursday, hours after police in Los Angeles cleared a pro-Palestinian protest camp at UCLA, where demonstrators had been told to leave. This report from our correspondent Emma Vardy, who spent the day following events at the campus in Los Angeles.
Police in riot gear moved in before dawn. They'd surrounded the pro-Palestine encampment at UCLA on all sides. Despite building a makeshift fortress around them, the protesters found their barricades soon overpowered. Deafening flashbang grenades were deployed by police, the bright lights and loud bangs used to disorientate protesters as the police moved in to clear the tents.
I'm just here to show support, amplify the message that the students are saying here.
It's very inspiring to see that the students are not backing down, that they are, you know, I mean, they're putting a lot on the line. They're risking arrest, they're risking their careers and their futures to actually, like, send this message. And it's very important and it's very inspiring.
Demonstrators linked arms, but police lines pushed them back. Some protesters say rubber bullets were used against them. The country has been waiting a long time for a response from the president about the growing protests and violence. Joe Biden finally spoke.
Breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not peaceful protest. It's against the law. Dissent is essential to democracy, but dissent must never lead to disorder or to denying the rights of others so students can finish the semester and their college education.
By morning, little remained of the encampment that had occupied the main quad of UCLA for a week. Police operations across the US have demonstrated that encampments will not be tolerated for long. At UCLA, it's disrupted many students' exam week and may still be some time before the campus returns to normality.
Emma Vardy. An international police operation by Europol has uncovered one of the largest networks of fraudulent call centres across Europe and beyond. The EU's law enforcement agency said officers in six countries were involved in the raids. German police initially monitored calls from the centres, listening in to the multiple scams. They said the operation has saved potential victims from losing over $100 million. Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, told me more about the criminal network behind the scam.
The scale of this enterprise really was remarkable. There were call centres in five countries, Germany, Albania, Bosnia, Kosovo and also Lebanon. And they were making more than 10,000 calls every single day. They were fake police calls. There were people trying to persuade their victims to invest in fictitious investment opportunities. There were some that promised romance. There were some demanding that debts be repaid. Of course, the debts were completely invented. I mean, I think probably most of us have received these kinds of fake calls, and many of us will know people who fell for it. And afterwards, they often say they can't believe how gullible they were. Well, what the police, the investigators are saying about these criminals were that they used a variety of manipulation tactics to shock and cheat their victims out of their savings.
So, Paul, how did the police catch them?
Well, it all started last December when a woman walked into a bank in Freiburg, southwest Germany, and asked to withdraw 100,000 euros. That's just over $100,000. Perhaps not surprisingly, the teller was a bit suspicious, called the police. The police came and talked to the woman and realised that she was the victim of a scam and that she was about to hand the money over to someone. The person turned up and was promptly arrested. Now, they could have stopped there, but they then looked at the numbers that were used, the telephone numbers to call this woman, and they realised they could link that to a whole network of calls that were being made in all these different countries. And so they launched what they called Operation Pandora, first hundreds of German officers involved, and then police all over the world monitoring the calls that were coming from these numbers. Eventually, they recorded 7,500, which they thought were clear evidence of scams. And at that point, they had enough evidence to launch a raid.
So what happened on this raid?
It was quite an operation because coordination was essential. You didn't want one lot to get caught and tip off the others. On the 18th of April, simultaneously, they raided these premises in five different countries, the ones I mentioned, Germany, Bosnia, Kosovo, Albania and Lebanon. They arrested 21 people, and they also seized a lot of equipment. They're hoping that that equipment might lead them to other scams being shut down, but you know, there's no way around it. This is a bit of a mole-bashing exercise, as it's sometimes called. You shut down one of these operations, another pops up. Here in London, the Metropolitan Police launched an operation only last month where they cracked down on one bunch of criminals that had managed to get more than $1 million out of its victims. I'm afraid that whatever success police have, this is a crime that's going to be with us for an awfully long time.
Paul Moss. Prosecutors at Donald Trump's hush money trial in New York have called for the former president to be fined for breaking his gagging order again. The court has been hearing more testimony from Stormy Daniels' former lawyer, detailing how a $130,000 payment to the adult film star was arranged. Mr. Trump denies falsifying business records to conceal illegal efforts to influence the 2016 election. From New York, our correspondent Neda Torfik reports.
The former president is settling back into the routine of being in court after two rallies yesterday in Wisconsin and Michigan. Mr. Trump spoke to reporters as he arrived.
It was nice to be able to campaign one day without being in this ridiculous show trial, Biden trial, I call it.
Keith Davidson, the lawyer who negotiated the Stormy Daniels hush money deal at the center of the case, took jurors back to election night in 2016. At that time, he sent a text message at 3 o'clock in the morning to an editor at the tabloid The National Enquirer. He asked the editor, "What have we done?" Explaining that message, Mr. Davidson told the court that there was an understanding that their efforts may have in some way assisted the presidential campaign of Donald Trump. When the Wall Street Journal published stories in 2018 about the payments to the adult film star and a Playboy model, Mr. Davidson detailed the crisis discussions that ensued with Mr. Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, on how to respond, including how to word a denial that Ms. Daniels issued but later rescinded. On cross-examination by the defense, Mr. Davidson was asked if he ever spoke to Mr. Trump, to which he replied, never. The day's proceedings had begun with yet another hearing about alleged violations of a limited gag order. The defense claimed that Mr. Trump, as a presidential candidate, was being silenced while everyone else could speak freely about the trial. To that, the judge reminded them that they were overlooking a very significant issue, Mr. Trump's position as the defendant.
Neda Torfik in New York. Russia has been accused of causing disruption to satellite navigation systems, affecting thousands of civilian flights. The problem escalated with the start of the invasion of Ukraine and is still getting worse. The areas worst affected are the Baltic, the Black Sea and the Eastern Mediterranean regions, where the Russian military has recently been very active. Vitaly Shevchenko reports.
The main target of such interference is the popular American Global Positioning System, or GPS. it has been subjected to jamming, as a result of which aircraft were unable to receive its signals. This week, the Finnish airline Finnair suspended its daily flights to Estonia's second-largest city, Tartu, after two of its aircraft had to return to Helsinki due to GPS interference. The airline says its pilots report several such cases of interference a day, and aviation officials say their total number exceeds 25,000. Estonia's foreign minister, Margus Tsahkna, points the finger of blame at Russia.
Our authorities, Estonian authorities, they confirm that the source of the interference is Russia. And this GPS signal is inferred with from Russia as well as from Kaliningrad and as well from this vicinity of St. Petersburg and also Pskov. So we have proofs that it is coming from Russia. They are violating our territories. So they are actually putting our people and also the civil airplanes in danger. And this is a violation of the international agreements. They cannot do that.
But why would Russia want to meddle with navigation signals? Keir Giles, director of the Conflict Studies Research Centre, a British think tank, believes that Moscow is sowing disruption and testing its ability for immobilising Europe. Another reason, he says, is defending against possible missile and drone attacks during the war with Ukraine.
Navigation systems can support drone operations as well as precision-guided munitions. And Ukraine has already found a way round Russia's GPS jamming using other navigational systems to carry out drone strikes deep into Russia. But, of course, that doesn't mean that Russia doesn't benefit from making sure that GPS simply does not work when Ukraine wants to use it to target Russian positions or infrastructure within Russia itself.
Losing connection to GPS does not pose an immediate threat to safety, as modern aircraft can normally use other ways of navigation. However, any disruption to such an important system is still a significant risk.
That report by Vitaly Shevchenko. For most of its long history, women have been excluded from taking part in the Tour de France cycling race, apart from on a handful of occasions. But that changed in 2022 when a new women's event was launched. This summer, we'll see the third edition of the Tour de France Femmes. There are some differences, though. Lexi O'Connor reports.
Through the mist, up to the summit, Davy Vollering takes the win on the iconic Tour de
France. It's the world's best-known cycling race, but though the Tour de France has been around since 1903, the women's version has only taken place on a handful of occasions, once in the 1950s and then again for a few years in the 1980s. Then in 2022, after a long campaign by female cyclists, a new women's race was launched. But the racers only take part for 8 days compared to the men's 3 weeks, and the women's combined prize pot is almost 10 times less than the men's.
Yeah, it's just really hard, to be honest. You're on your limit pretty much the whole time, especially when you're racing at the front.
I'm in a back garden in Stockport, Northern England, and pro cyclist Alice Wood is putting her bike away after a morning training session. Last year, Alice raced the Tour de France Femmes with Team Human Powered Health, something that as a young girl, she didn't think she'd ever be able to do.
Some of the questions that you're always asked is, have you ever done the Tour de France? And it was never an option to be able to say yes, because it was not a possibility for me as a female cyclist.
We'll come back to Alice later. Fun fact, though, the full name of the race is the Tour de France Femmes Avec Zwift. That company signed a 4-year deal to sponsor the race in 2022.
I didn't see this as a risk. I saw this more as a real exciting opportunity.
Meet Zwift CEO and co-founder Eric Min.
It is a long-term investment. I think we're just only getting started, and the first 2 years have been, you know, very successful. It's beaten all the targets that ASO and Zwift have set. So I don't see this slowing down. I only see this getting bigger.
Mind games between Damien Vollering and Annemiek van Vleuten as we approach the Col du Tour Malay. But now being
TV viewing figures for the women's race have been growing. On the broadcaster Eurosport, 15 million people watched the race last year. That's a 7% increase on the year before.
Though the figures are impressive and growing, the women's race doesn't pull in anywhere near the viewing figures that the men's race gets.
The Tour de France men's race is 100 years old, and it would be completely unfair to compare any other race that started in the last 4 years, men's or women's, to that.
Guy Voisin is Senior Director of Cycling at Warner Brothers Discovery, which owns Eurosport.
The women's race started with a huge bang. For us, all Grand Tours broke records last year. The women's racing package is up 25% year on year for us, and it's growing.
We began this by hearing from Tour de France competitor Alice Wood. I wanted to get her thoughts on the disparity between the men's total prize fund of 2.3 million euros and the women's prize fund of 250,000 euros, almost 10 times less.
It's obviously not equal. I also know that the prize money, for me, is always a benefit at the end of the day. You don't go to the race to win the prize money, you go to do the best result and hopefully win stages, and the prize money is kind of a cherry on the cake, I guess.
Pro cyclist Alice Wood ending that report by Lexi O'Connor. Still to come, the billionaires in a land of supposed social equality.
We have become more of a mentality of winner takes it all, that if you just play your cards right, you can also become a billionaire, so why raise the taxes? That's quite a significant shift, I think, in Swedish mentality.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the debate around what to do with around $300 billion US of Russian money frozen as part of Western sanctions against the Kremlin. Political backing is growing for at least some of those funds to pay for Ukraine's war effort. But would this break international law and potentially put off investment from other major players? Just search for the Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The French Parliament has voted to set up a commission to investigate sexual abuse in the film industry and other cultural sectors. It comes off the back of a string of recent allegations of sexual assault and rape by high-profile stars, such as the actor Gérard Depardieu. This week, Green Party lawmaker Francesca Pasquini welcomed the decision.
Il est temps.
It's time to stop rolling out the red carpet for abusers. We owe it to the thousands of victims who have spoken out, and I hope they will continue to do so.
So what is the scope of this commission? Hugh Schofield is our correspondent in Paris.
It'll look at the problem which they've identified in the film industry, but not just in the film industry, in the sort of arts industries more widely, into sexual abuse. Originally, the remit was supposed to be into abuse of teenagers, of minors, but I think it's more broadly been extended to abuse of anyone. The idea being that there is an endemic problem going back many, many years based around the influence of certain key people, mainly men, directors, actors and so on, who have used their influence and their power to have their way with young women, women of all ages. All of this going back, of course, to the case of Judith Godrèche, the actress who was in Parliament today when this was voted on, whose revelations about her own past are very, very much behind all of this.
You mentioned Ms. Godrèche there. To what extent is this a result of years of issues that have been swept under the carpet coming to the fore now?
I mean, that remains to be seen, but certainly what we have seen in the last couple of years are more and more cases like this, and not just in the film industry, but in the world of literature as well. Obviously, part of it is very much a sort of parallel with the Me Too movement and the Harvey Weinstein stories. Indeed, Judith Godrèche was one of the women who complained about him when that all began. What she would say, and I think it's true, is that there's a particularly French context to this, which makes it a bit different from the context elsewhere. The origin of this, certainly for her, was a kind of intellectual environment in the 70s, 80s and 90s extending up to today, which means that people who are honoured and regarded as culturally significant in the world of film or of literature are given huge power and not questioned in any way. So it was that in her case, she was at the age of 14, 15, living with a man of 40, the film director Benoît Jacquot, who she's filed suit against now, because of an atmosphere at the time which made it impossible for people to say, oh, that's just not right. It would have been regarded as rather backward-looking back then to say that there was a problem there. But it was the intellectual atmosphere, the cultural atmosphere, which allowed these directors, these actors, these people of influence in the arts to get away with what they did.
And now we've got this commission. Would you say that this commission is likely to bring about a change in the culture across France, or has that already happened, do you think?
I think it's already happening. There are people who say that France is still dragging its feet in all of this, and they would point to the Gérard Depardieu affair and the way that President Macron famously leapt to his defence a couple of months back when his name was being exposed as that of someone who's allegedly committed sexual abuse. What will happen with this commission? I don't know. I mean, it's only a parliamentary commission. It's only a group of MPs who are going to look into this, make recommendations. It may be that there'll be laws that are change, but I suspect it's much more of a cultural thing that has to change.
Hugh Schofield in France. The family of a gay British-Mexican man, Manuel Guerrero Avina, held in Qatar for alleged drug offences, has given further details of what they say was a honey trap operation using the gay dating app Grindr. According to his brother Enrique, Manuel was approached online by a man called Gio, and they arranged to meet. But he was instead met by police and arrested on false drug charges. His family say Manuel, who has HIV, has now completely run out of his usual medication. James Reynolds spoke to our diplomatic correspondent Caroline Hawley and LGBT and identity producer Josh Parry, who've both been working on this story, and have spoken to Enrique. Caroline told us first more about Manuel.
He is an airline manager. He's 44 years old. As you said, he's a British-Mexican passport holder. He'd worked in Qatar happily for 7 years with a good job, a nice apartment, until February. And that was when he was approached over initially Grindr, then Tinder, by somebody calling themselves Gio, who wanted to meet up with him, who wanted him to bring other gay men. The man that he thinks is Gio rings the doorbell when they do arrange to meet up, and Manuel asks him to come up to the apartment, and he says, no, come down to the lobby. And when he goes down to the lobby of his building, he is handcuffed. And the family say that drugs are then planted on him. He's taken to a police station, according to his brother, where he sees four people being whipped. He says that in the police station, he sees a whole unit of policemen on a whole range of gay dating apps. And when he sees people being whipped, he's told that that could happen to him too if he doesn't confess. They want him to unlock his phone, share details of his sexual partners. Eventually, he does thumbprint a confession. And Amnesty International has described it all as a horrific experience. And the family says he experienced homophobic comments, that he was held in a crowded cell with dozens of people when it was meant for far less, that he was put in solitary confinement when they found out he had HIV because they were worried it could be passed on, that at one point he went for 15 to 20 hours without food or water, that medication was withheld in a way of pressuring him. So accounts that Human Rights Watch and other human rights activists have expressed concern about, and they've said this does fit a pattern of how Qatar has treated LGBT people in the past.
And let's turn to Josh now. Tell us more about Grindr.
So Grindr is it would call itself a social networking app for the gay, bisexual and trans male community. But really what it's largely used for is kind of hookup, shall we say, or more casual encounters might be a more polite way of putting it. And it, but also when you think internationally and you look at the picture where in more than 60 countries it's still illegal to be gay. In those countries, Grindr says it can be a real lifeline to people trying to make a community when perhaps it's not safe or advised to create that community in person. And so it's really used for a real wide range of things, but it has become a real staple of the LGBT community.
And Caroline, to the story then, back to the story of Manuel Guerrero Avina, what situation is he in right now?
Well, he is on provisional release. There was a court hearing last Monday. He has been charged with using and possessing drugs. He's staying with friends because he hasn't been paid since all this happened, so he can't afford to keep up his apartment. His passport has been taken away. And Amnesty, who I referred to earlier, are concerned about whether he can get a fair trial when for weeks he had no lawyer, no translator when he was in jail. And he didn't know the exact charges against him or have any access to court documents until just a few days before the court hearing. But the situation is out on provisional release at the moment. But he has run out now of the medication prescribed for him by UK doctors.
And what has the state of Qatar said?
Well, they are absolutely insisting that this is all about drugs. They say he acknowledged the possession of them. Now, his family says it was a confession that he was forced to make in the middle of the night, and then at the court hearing later that he denied it and has always denied possessing and using drugs. The Qataris say that a drugs test confirmed the presence in his body of amphetamine and methamphetamine. The family don't deny that there was some kind of a drugs test, but say the result was just a scribbled note claiming the presence of these controlled substances. The Qataris insist it wasn't about his sexuality, and they said it was just about drugs. No other factors were taken into account, they said in a statement, and they insist he was treated with dignity and respect.
Caroline Hawley and Josh Parry. Has Sweden become a paradise for the super rich? For decades, the Nordic country has enjoyed a global reputation for championing social equality. But there's been a rapid boom in the number of Swedish multimillionaires and even billionaires in recent years. And there are growing debates about how that's impacting the economy and Swedish values. I spoke to Maddie Savage in Stockholm.
The rhetoric coming out of the tech scene over the last few years has been one of, well, we're a country that's tech savvy, we're a digital country, we've got a culture of innovation and collaboration, and that's enabled us to punch above our weight in tech and business, creating a lot of new dollar billionaires and millionaires in relation to our population size. Sweden has just 10 million people living there. But another argument has been coming through, pushed by a Swedish author and journalist called Andreas Svenker, who recently wrote a book called Greedy Sweden. And he pointed out that there have been things like tech companies and property shooting up in value because of low interest rates until recently. And also that Sweden has, surprisingly perhaps, a tax system that favours the super rich. So although taxes on salaries here are high, the taxes you pay on money made from stocks and payouts to shareholders is much lower. And Sweden's also scrapped inheritance tax. So that's made it easier in some ways for the rich to get richer over the last couple of decades and for new entrepreneurs to break through.
And Maddie, you've been speaking to millionaires and billionaires about how they've made and spent their money, haven't you?
Yeah, I got to look around quite a fancy mansion and to meet up with some very wealthy individuals. But what's interesting is that a lot of Swedes are quite subtle in terms of how they spend their money. So it's quite rare to build, say, a massive house with 20 bedrooms or to own a fleet of yachts or cars. Here's Ola Alvarsson, who's a serial entrepreneur who's been running businesses since the 90s.
Sweden has a tradition of frugality, as championed by the likes of IKEA. The CEO and founder never went first class and so forth. There's a lot of rhetorics around the frugal Swede. If you spend money on unnecessary luxury, in Switzerland that means that you are a gentleman and you have style and finesse. In Sweden it means you're immature if you put too much money into fancy cars and gold watches and so forth.
He told me he's not materialistic and he spends a lot of his money on property and throwing parties. There's also a trend for something called impact investing in Sweden. So reinvesting in companies that improve society or the environment. Sweden's top in the EU when it comes to this. The country's had a long focus and interest in sustainability, but perhaps it's also linked to this lack of flashiness in Sweden. People can feel a bit uncomfortable with too much wealth, so they reinvest it.
And Maddie, is there much debate in Sweden about the rise of the super rich?
Surprisingly little. There's currently a right-wing coalition in power, so you might understand why it's not their top priority. So to summarise, I think Sweden's perhaps not as equal as its global image or the global stereotype that it's had over the last few years. And interestingly, a lot of the wealth is concentrated in the hands of white men as well.
And you can listen to Maddie's documentary, Super Rich Swedes, on the BBC World Service online and wherever you get your podcasts. Now, a first for wildlife observation. An orangutan in Indonesia has been spotted apparently treating himself for a wound on his face using a poultice made from a plant. He was seen making a paste with the chewed up leaves of a medicinal plant. Our science reporter, Georgina Rannard, explains.
This is how it started. Rakus the orangutan crying out before he was injured in what was probably a fight with other males. It left him with a large red wound under his right eye. What happened next amazed researchers in the Gunung-Leuser National Park. They saw Rakus chewing the leaves of the medicinal plant Akar Kuning, which has antibacterial properties that local people use to treat malaria. After chomping for 7 minutes, he put some leafy liquid on his injury. Then he chewed the leaves into a paste and applied it onto his wound, covering the sore as if with a poultice or a plaster. 5 days later, the scientists saw the wound had closed up, and within a month it had healed. Isabel Laumer is a biologist at the Max Planck Institute in Konstanz, Germany. She says it's another reminder of how closely related we are to great apes.
We humans, we treat our wounds, but also forms of active wound treatment can be found in the African great apes and also in the Asian great apes. It's also possible that our last common ancestor already showed similar ointment behavior. So these are the evolutionary implications of this behavior.
Researchers already knew that chimpanzees sometimes swallowed leaves with known medicinal properties. But this is the first time that a wild animal has been seen applying some to a wound. The scientists will now be watching other orangutans to try to find out if these medical skills are unique to Rakus or more widely used.
Georgina Rannard. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Kouzaris. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.